Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM in Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Today we hear more from Alex Alam Eldin of Eat Smart New York. Then Lavonia Mallory speaks with Dr. Clem Harris on reclaiming history. After that, on Climate Matters, Peter Savio speaks with Jennifer Otney Mahar of the Nature Conservancy. Then Hannah and Jules discuss the importance of mindfulness on creating spaces for healing. And finally, we have the debut of Sophia K. Helene's Women in STEM Bucket. Today, she speaks with RPI professor Esther Wirtz. But first, let's hear some local headlines.
The Times Union reports that Robert King agreed Friday to give up his firearms in what is believed to be the first such case resolved since New York's red flag law took place last month. The law allows firearms to be taken away from individuals who may be extreme risks to themselves or others. Robert King, a contractor in Eastern Rensselaer County, relinquished a pistol and more than half a dozen rifles. On September 3rd, Robert King allegedly fired a pistol, shot and struck a neighbor's car, and later indicated he would commit suicide.
A fourth man has been arrested in the growing hay bale vandalism scandal in Hoosick Falls, according to the Times Union. State police say the men went on a beer run, then rolled bales of hay into the middle of a street, set them on fire, and spray-painted the road, a vehicle, and a barn door.
The Troy Record reports that the city of Troy is soliciting bids on construction at Historic Powers Park. The work includes installation of new sidewalks and curbing on the east and south side of the park, as well as replacement of older sidewalks, curbings along 2nd Avenue and 110th Street.
Capital Region mental health professionals and advocates gathered at Capital West Park on Thursday afternoon to speak on the dangers of separating and detaining immigrant families and their children. Dr. Mary Panzetta, a psychiatrist at the event, expressed her frustration that CBP's family separations policy creates preventable, lifelong trauma for youth separated from their parents.
New York Attorney General Letitia James on Thursday ordered a company that sells Me Too-labeled sexual assault evidence kits to stop selling the kits. The Attorney General directed the Me Too kit company and Preserve Group to cease and desist selling the at-home products. James' move comes in response to concerns that the results of the at-home kits might be inadmissible in court. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM in Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, and I'm still Lavonia Mallory.
And I'll continue to be Guy Schaefer until further notice. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, send an email to mediasanctuary.org. That's HMM at mediasanctuary.org. In our first segment tonight, we hear from Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce, who's speaking with Alex Alam Eldin from the Cornell Cooperative Extension about her nutrition education work in Eat Smart New York.
These are troubled times for people who eat, and I think you're doing what you can to make eating a healthier activity for folks. Tell us a little bit about what Eat Smart New York is.
Yeah, so Eat Smart New York is a nutrition education program that's free to all individuals who qualify and or are receiving benefits through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. We work within the Capital Region, and we expand through extended portions of New York State. We work with our counter partners that are in different regions, but Eat Smart New York hits all of New York State.
And how did Cornell Cooperative Extension get involved in this program? Why is it run by Cornell as opposed to a state or government agency?
Extension is a national program. Cornell is the land grant college that receives that grant through Extension. In Vermont, the University of Vermont is the land-grant college that receives the grant and provides extension through there. So Cornell has just always been the extension college that we execute this national program through.
And because it's agriculture-related food products, it makes sense to do that.
Correct.
And what is what drives the need for a program like Eat Smart New York?
So the poverty and the obesity levels within, you know, our country. Our funding comes from the USDA. It's SNAP benefits. And so, you know, you go through your process of qualifying for your SNAP benefits, and that's through the poverty thresholds. And once you are qualified and or receiving benefits, you are then eligible to receive additional services like this nutrition education component on how to use your benefits.
And who is on SNAP? How many people? What sorts of folks? I mean, for people who don't use the benefits, they might not. There are stereotypes about it, but are there a lot of folks who receive SNAP benefits?
Yeah, in just the capital region, our SNAP caseload is very high. You know, it could be someone that you work with that is receiving SNAPs and SNAP benefits and you don't even know, or it can be someone that you've seen go into a food pantry. So it definitely is an invisible thing that you don't always know who's eligible or receiving SNAP benefits, but it does have to do with your income levels to be eligible to receive SNAP benefits.
And do you have a sense of the numbers of people in the capital region, or like a percentage, or just roughly?
I could look those up. They're on the OTDA website, and those numbers are published. They're called SNAP caseloads, and they're, you know, there's very specific numbers of to families receiving SNAP, what those SNAP dollars actually look like in number amounts. So it's all online.
I remember being surprised at how many people get the benefits. I thought it was a small group.
Yeah, no, it's not.
It's almost half the people in the country, I think.
It's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember a program that was referred to colloquially as food stamps. Was that a different thing, or is this a new name for the same thing?
It's a new name. I think it's been called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program for a long time. Food stamps was also kind of a slang type of thing. We do EBT benefits now because it's more electronic. But yeah, same program, same idea.
What are the sorts of things that you, do in the Eat Smart New York program?
So we provide nutrition education workshops, material and messaging throughout the community. And we really look at the environment as a whole and try to see where we can make environmental changes, whether it's policy or system. And then through that, our ultimate goal is to increase fruit and vegetable consumption within our community and our priority population, as well as to educate those to, you know, drink more beverages that are, to drink less sweetened beverages, increase water consumption, or just 100% fruit juice, things like that, and to exercise more and have more of a calorie-balanced input-output.
It seems counterintuitive to me that our commercial media system is really heavily based on promoting the consumption of food products that are bad for you, that are that increase obesity and disease problems. So we spend a huge amount of time and money educating young people to eat poorly, and then we have a nutrition program that tries to teach them to eat more healthfully. Does that seem odd?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, at Cornell and Eat Smart New York, we just try to do the best we can. All of our educators have a background in nutrition. And when we're out in the field, we try to meet people where they're at. You know, we try to give them the tools that they need at the time, whether that's learning how to read a label, whether that's knowing how to dice an onion to make your own fresh meals, or, you know, tips on budgeting. You know, we try to meet people where they're at so that they can use those tools and that they can make their lifestyle healthier.
And is the education oriented towards the individual? If I had questions, there's somebody I could call or come in to see, or is it more of a group learning environment that you work in?
Our nutrition educators are more in a group learning environment. However, when we are out in the field, say at a health fair or somewhere where there's multiple people, but it's not necessarily a workshop or a class, we do talk to people one-on-one. They come They might have specific questions, or maybe they're just looking for resources. We also answer the phone all the time and try to provide those resources. And then we also have a website.
And what's the biggest challenge you face when in your work?
I think just the variety of people and like I said before, meeting people we're at, everyone has a different story. Everyone has a different background. Everyone has different experiences that they're bringing to the table. So really being able to adapt when we're out in the field, because we really approach it all.
And where do you do most of your education?
Throughout the Capital Region, we, you know, are all the way up in Washington County, and we're all the way down near Hudson. So, and we scope a wide range of people.
Do you go to schools or?
Yep, we are in schools. We are in community centers. We're in senior centers. So there's no age limit because SNAP affects everyone, and poverty, food insecurity affects everyone. So there really is no age limit. We do encounter it all, and individual and families.
And has there been any impact of national policy on SNAP benefits? Or is it pretty steady, or is that a politically controversial area?
I think it ranges. Last year, you know, we did see with the shutdown, there was a lag in SNAP benefits. That's not really what we deal with specifically. We just try to, you know, understand what's happening. And then during that time period, we might share more resources on how to budget and how to stretch that food dollar just a little bit more, because they might not be able to receive their services that month. So we're just more on the, you know, the individual level, trying to help them get through. We're not so into the us making policy or, you know, working on that side of things.
And how do people receive the education tips that you give them? Are people generally open to it, or they think, oh, that's too hard, or not interested?
Yeah. I mean, like I said before, our educators are really good at adapting in a situation. So, if they get into a class or they're in a workshop where the level of experience is super low, then they can adapt. We've also been in classes where the level is super high, and they are pretty good at cooking meals at their own. And so we can then maybe ramp up that class a little bit more. But yeah, we try to meet people where they're at, and it changes every time.
Great. If people want to find out more about Eat Smart New York and the cooperative extension, where can they go?
They can go to capitalregionesny.org.
Well, thanks so much for stopping by.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
We just heard from Alex Alam Eldin about her nutrition education work with Eat Smart New York.
Our next segment is a continuation of the Reclaiming History Bucket done by my co-host this evening, Lavonia Mallory. You're about to hear her interviewing Dr. Clem Harris from Utica College.
Dr. Clem Harris is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Utica College, where he teaches interdisciplinary courses in African American urban history, African diasporic history, and public affairs. Dr. Harris holds a PhD in history with a graduate certificate in urban studies and Africana studies received from the University of Pennsylvania in 2013. He has received fellowships for research in areas such as democracy, citizenship, and constitutionalism and Africana studies. His recent book manuscript for the University of Pennsylvania Press, entitled Reconstructing Philadelphia, The Persistence of Racism and the African American Struggle for Political Leverage and Civil Rights, is a case study that examines the roles of electoral and protest politics in the struggle for racial equality in the urban North from the abolition era to the 1980s. His second book project is a historical analysis on the politics and the policies of Philadelphia's first two-term African-American mayor, W. Wilson Good Sr. Prior to earning his PhD, Harris worked as a high-level aide to the governor of New York, where his influence helped shape a host of social and economic reforms, including drug law reform, reform of New York City's racial profiling policy, economic justice initiatives such as the 2010 Business Diversification Act, the establishment of the state's first chief diversity officer, and the creation of the nation's strongest minority and women-owned business program. Dr. Harris, in our last segment, you were talking about the importance of young African-American people understanding their history. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Why is that important?
Only through developing a very wide analysis rooted in histories that are not typical. In other words, to ask them to think about how different has the social relations to power rooted in race changed from the very first time that a person of from Africa stepped foot on the North American continent to the present. No one is going to direct you to me unless you have a type of interest, an intellectual curiosity.
Do you believe that the sheer knowledge of one's own cultural history is in some way a barrier or a hedge of protection or a defense against the multi-pronged onslaught of racism and classism and sexism that is constantly coming at the young person of color? Is sheer knowledge of one's own history, is that knowledge itself a protection against racism?
Well, I think it's not necessarily a protection against racism, because racism is about power. That history is, quite frankly, about knowledge of the power structures, right? It is about recognizing how to strategically identify these power structures and to think about them in strategic ways, rather than to sort of see these power structures as a fait accompli. This is just the way that it is. No, it's not the way that it is. It is this way because of the power dynamic that has happened. And then to think about, where do Black people fit within this broader structure? Listen, one of the things in some of my seminars that, you know, teach seminars on Black politics, I say to them that one of the major challenges of being forcibly brought into Western systems and then having one's labor and body, quite frankly, plundered, is the realization that when freedom finally came, freedom came politically without the economic means to maintain it. Is that right? Really freedom, right? I often teach that there's a dialectical relationship between, you know, the politics and economic power, right? You mm-hmm. can't have mm-hmm. one without the other, right?
Sure. Right.
And so why have Black people been so overwhelmingly in this country reliant upon having allies, particularly in the federal government, to help them? Is largely because the state and local governments still, to this very day, are willing to abridge the rights of Black citizens. Just listen to what the president said of four women of color, all of whom are citizens, right?
Right.
He just told
right.
them the right. And so this is a clear indication, right? Black people, in not only in this country, but even when you think about the broader issue of global colonialism, freedom came after the dominant Western powers had extracted wealth and resources out of, you know, these countries, certainly on the continent of Africa and arguably in, you know, the diaspora. They said, okay, well, you can now have freedom, but they don't have the economic means by which to maintain freedom. And, you know, we see those countries today as emerging economies. Earlier, they were called third world countries. The third world countries were the former colonies of the first world countries. The countries were the colonial powers, right? The Western powers.
Right.
So this history is really very important, because to understand how to have any type of strategic awareness of where you are, you have to understand from whence you've come.
We're in a two-party system. We have the Democratic Party and we have the Republican Party, the party of Reagan, you know? So that's mm-hmm. always the view that I have of the Republican Party. But then we have the Democratic Party, and that is supposed to be the party that African Americans turn to address our needs, our issues, our struggles. But mm-hmm. in your article, you said something very interesting. So I'm going to quote you, and just have some patience with me. I'm going to read what mm-hmm. you said, and I really want you to answer this question. This is what you said: the Democratic Party will likely continue to fail because its strategies for outreach to the African American community were continued reliance on traditional modalities of Black leadership from the baby boomers, right? And so mm-hmm. they're not looking at the new generation, they're looking at the old generation. Mm-hmm. Why first of all, why is that? Why don't they look to the young millennials, the Black millennials, number one? Why are they looking back? Why aren't they looking forward? And what do we as Black people need to do to try to help, if we want to stay in the Democratic Party, help them address our needs?
So let me deal with the first question, the first part of that question. The first part of that question is because the Democratic Party is essentially relying on the heyday of the party, which was during the 1960s, right? It is right. relying on its heyday. And the Democratic Party historically, Lavonia, is doing pretty much the same thing that the Republican Party did in the early 20th century. The Republican Party in the early 20th century had already abandoned Black civil rights. It ended de jure segregation, right? But Black people were not the only ones to benefit from that. White women also benefited tremendously from that.
Right, right.
And so there is no policy that has sought to relieve, the systemic issues of racism that target Black people. No remedies have solely resulted in helping Black people to the exclusion of others. Quite the contrary. Helping Black people is the morally right thing to do, because in helping Black people, you help everyone as well.
Oh my goodness, Dr. Harris, we are out of time.
All right, that was part three of my interview with Dr. Harris in Reclaiming History. Tune in for part four, Guy.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm still Lavonia Mallory, and you're still listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
In this segment, Jessica Otley Mahar discusses the Nature Conservatory's history and role here in New York and across the U.S. and internationally. Jessica discusses their long-standing role in protecting land as well as its complementary role in policy and advocacy. This includes discussions of recently passed climate legislation here in New York.
Welcome to Climate Matters. We are here with Jessica Otney Mahar from the Nature Conservancy. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great. Appreciate you being here. Jessica, talk to us a little bit about the background history of the Nature Conservancy and how you came to find yourself there.
That's a great story. Well, the Nature Conservancy was actually founded right here in New York. Residents and scientists came together with a shared vision to protect and care for nature. And our first project was protecting 60 acres of New York forests in Westchester County. So big organization with roots right here in New York State. I found my way to the Nature Conservancy 13 years ago after working for a couple of other environmental organizations. And I started working in this field after growing up in suburban upstate New York and watching a lot of farms and fields be subdivided and thinking about that in my studies in high school and college. And really thinking about how to use my education and interests in politics to work on conservation and environmental issues.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So how long have you been with the Nature Conservancy?
So this is my 13th year with
Wow.
the Nature Conservancy.
Okay.
Yeah. I never envisioned staying somewhere for so long, but I always tell people now if they allow me to stay, they'll wheel me out because it's an amazing place to work with amazing people. And I'm really proud of the work that the Conservancy does, both in New York and globally. Mm. And I'm really thrilled to be a part of it.
So founded in New York and now international, correct?
Yeah, we're the largest conservation organization in the world, and we're in all 50 states.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. what role does the Nature Conservancy actually play? Is it a development rights or conservation easements, or is it direct ownership? What's the priority focus?
Yeah, so when we first started, we were a land trust. And so we focused on buying and conserving land. And we've since grown into a much more diverse organization. We do applied science now to further conservation in partnership with academia and government organizations and agencies. So we have hundreds of incredible scientists working on all sorts of issues. We do oceans conservation and freshwater conservation. So we've moved from the land into the water. And we're also working on issues like tackling climate change and thinking about how communities can become more resilient in the face of the impacts that we know are still here to stay, even as we do work to mitigate climate change. So we've become really more than just a land trust. While we are still a land trust, we've become really full-fledged environmental organization. I obviously do advocacy work, but in addition to that, we do projects in communities with people to make improvements to those communities.
Hmm. So the two, I suspect, feed off of one another. The actions and activities in the communities provide a base of support and modeling of sustainable infrastructure, and then the applications with policy. You have some direct experience and community engagement to point to and bring to the table. Is that the part of the function? Or
Yeah, exactly. And one of the exciting parts about my work is that the positions that we take on issues when working on public policy and urging lawmakers to dedicate public funding to different causes come out of that work that we do in communities. And so we're working to find solutions for people that benefit both people and nature. And there are oftentimes projects or programs that we're working on with people that can either utilize those policies and that funding or have demonstrated the need and the value of those things in communities.
And when you spoke of some of the issues that have where the Nature Conservancy has branched out and broadened its mission, in terms of advocacy, what are the kind of top policy priorities regionally and in New York State in particular?
Well, we just finished legislative session in 2019, and so this year we were really focused on having the state enact a climate policy, and we were successful in doing that. That was very exciting with a lot of partners. We also work on funding with a lot of partners, work to support the Environmental Protection Fund, which pays for all of the state's capital projects on the environment, and also a major clean water fund. The state has now dedicated $3 billion to fixing our water infrastructure around the state, which is imperative if we're going to have healthy drinking water and clean water to swim and fish and boat in. So those are some of the big ones. We also want to protect our state's wetlands, our streams, and work to make sure that communities have the ability to generate conservation funding at the local level and leverage all of those state funds that we're creating.
With that engagement on multiple levels within state policy, is there in energy and climate policy, we often face a bit of a bi-state perspective on things. Lower Hudson Valley, New York City, and Long Island, with a population density and a more vibrant economy, upstate patchiness of a vibrant economy, and in other parts of upstate, a little bit more struggling or slow growth. Does that present some challenges in terms of engagement with elected officials or engagement with policymakers in general?
I think it depends on the policy. There's a number of things that we've been working on where the policy is really intended on providing communities the opportunity to do something that works for them. So a concrete example, This year we worked to have a law passed that would enable communities to use transferable development rights, which is a planning tool, to deal with the issue of sea level rise and flooding. So, this issue might manifest itself very differently. For example, in a Westchester County town along the Hudson River than it would in a town on the South Shore of Long Island. Mm-hmm. And we're not saying that the bill doesn't say this is how the town should deal with this problem. What it does is say this is another tool, and now the town can go to work locally with its own planners, with its own people, and create an opportunity to deal with this issue using this tool. So there's a lot of issues, particularly as they relate to climate, where one of the things we need to be doing is creating an incentive or an ability for communities to really think about these issues in their own planning and then apply the principle locally in a way that it works for them. Mm. And that allows you to really span the upstate downstate divide or the rural urban divide, or even just differences that can be pretty shocking within in a county. I mean, if you look here in Albany County, a large town like, say, the town of Colony, where I live, versus a more rural town with a lot of farms, mm-hmm. Places that are a little bit more on the outskirts of the county, they have very different issues relating to traffic, relating to transit, building patterns. Absolutely. And so ensuring that they have some guiding principles from state on policy, but then can go to work to protect the things that people care most about and be a part of a solution is an important way to approach it.
Mm. So these additions to the tool set so that communities can tailor their local planning requirements to fit their priorities, their needs, as well as their challenges. I wasn't quite sure when you were describing it. Has that enabling legislation passed to allow for transfer of development rights?
Yeah, so the legislation that passed allows the use of that tool, transferable development rights, to be used for properties impacted by sea level rise.
Okay.
So the governor still has to sign that bill, but that was passed by both houses this session.
Great. So mechanically, how would that work? Would the planning board or zoning board of appeals, what would their role be, and under what circumstances would it happen?
Well, it's however the town is using TDRs right now, transferable development rights right now. So they would have to go through the process that's in place or that they would have to establish and think about, if you have density or development rights in one area, and in this case, if sea level rise was impacting that area, and you wanted to then use this tool to perhaps move people out of harm's way, for example, and then there's not space in your community, or you want to create an economic development zone in another area of your community, shift that tax base away from a vulnerable area to a more resilient area, you could then use this tool to create additional development rights in that other area.
Great. Interesting. Great to hear about the progress. So we are here on Climate Matters with Jessica Otney Mahar from the Nature Conservancy, the first of three segments here. So thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
That was Jessica Otney Mahar discussing the Nature Conservatory's history. To learn more about the Nature Conservatory, go to www.nature.org.
In this next segment, Hannah and Jules go more in depth on specifically what mindfulness is and how we can incorporate it into our daily lives.
Creating healing space with Hannah and Jules. Hey everybody, Jules and Hannah back again. Today we're going to continue talking about mindfulness. But before we start, what is mindfulness? Hannah, can you help us out?
It's pretty simple. Mindfulness is something that as humans we're naturally able to do. It just takes a little bit of work. So let's get into the definition, right? Mindfulness is being present. Being present and being aware of what you're doing, how you're doing it, really kind of tuning into our five senses. It's technically meditation, but a great meditation that doesn't really mean that you have to sit and say om or all those things. Kind of just, even while you're going throughout your day, say that you're feeling anxious while you're driving and there's a lot of things happening, a lot of things going on. Take note, but do it in a peaceful way. Like, what color are the trees? What color are the leaves on the trees? What color are the cars in front of you? How are you feeling? Just tuning in to like those five senses, things that you can see, things that you can hear.
Okay, so mindfulness isn't really about creating this space of quietness or quieting the mind, really. It's more so about creating a space that's free of judgment. And
who inspires you?
You're within that space. Because those kinds of spaces are the grounds for healing. And that's really where healing starts, is by removing any sort of judgment of yourself and taking an inventory, doing a body scan, finding where the anxiety lives, finding where the hurt and the pain lives, and nurturing the healing of those spaces, of those areas.
Exactly. So taking notice, being aware, but as these thoughts of like what you're paying attention to in that moment, doing it without judgment, not being like, oh my God, but why would I think that? Or like, it doesn't have to be that. So allowing yourself to be present in the moment without being harsh to yourself, which is easier said than done. But I feel like it just takes a little bit of practice, like anything. It's exercise for your brain.
What would you say are like some of the first steps? Maybe like ridding yourself of distractions?
Definitely. I think for beginners, maybe setting a time for just like maybe 5 minutes, right? Or maybe even less than that. Say you're busy. Hey, it's cool, right? You're at your lunch break. Go to the break room if it's quiet. Go to your car. Have a seat. Chill with yourself. And then take an inventory. Like, I'm in my car. What do I feel right now? What am I seeing? Okay, it's fall. I see and I notice that the leaves on the trees are changing to this pale yellow and the sky is like immaculately blue and gorgeous and there's people walking by, but yet they're living their own lives and doing that without judgment, like allowing those thoughts to come.
Yeah, and getting yourself out of that me movie that's constantly playing in our heads, that mini series of our own lives that we're constantly playing back and reflecting on.
You can even start with like mindfully eating, which is fun.
Ooh, I like that.
Like, ooh, say you're eating spaghetti. What do the noodles taste like? What do they feel like in my mouth as they go down my throat, as they settle in my stomach, as I go for that glass of water? How does the water cup, or the cup of water feel in my hand? Like the condensation that might be happening and just taking in all those sensations, but allowing yourself to be fully and present in that moment without judging those thoughts and those things is basically the basis and the stepping stone for it. It takes us away from that me movie that plays in our mind.
Yeah, I liked the point that you made about noticing other people, noticing people in your immediate surroundings. Because just as human beings, I feel like we have a tendency of getting really caught up in our own little drama, our own little mini series that's happening. And rightfully so. I mean, you got to take control of your life and you got to be in charge of your life and your actions. But at the same time, it's really important to check in with like the human race as it stands and everyone around you, and just acknowledge that we're all connected. We all share the same space. We all share this environment. And we're all equally responsible for caring for this earth.
Yes, exactly. And so I think while we are in that state of noticing and being highly aware, like our senses are heightened, like Spider-Man or that of, I don't know, whatever, a super person, a superhuman. Anyway, allowing ourselves to see those people, but to not let like their situations and their energy necessarily seep into what we're doing and how we're feeling. So I think that's one of the main dope things about mindfulness, just creating that space for you to purposely exist. A lot of times we're on autopilot, and so we're just going through life doing things that we do every day where it doesn't really force us to think about
our impact, really, and the interconnectedness of everything. But the practice of mindfulness is really about being present and aware of what we're doing so that we can have a healthier impact on our lives, on ourselves, to our bodies, and ultimately on our environment.
Mindfulness allows you to step into actually being present in that moment, which is hard. I mean, it's 2019 and we could be like, oh my God, I want to go hang out with my friends. And like everybody's on their phone. And it's like, dude, nobody's being present. Nobody's in the moment. Nobody is going into this meeting and this gathering with intention. And so being mindful really just sets the tone and the mood for your day, for your life in general. And it's just so crucial.
What are some like really basic practices of mindfulness, and like how can we begin to start in incorporating this into daily practice?
Yeah, so like I stated earlier, I mean, it's chilling by yourself, setting a tone, setting a mood, setting some space for yourself to breathe. Actually, when I was at Four Winds, my therapist told me to go into my room, to shut the door behind me, maybe put on some noise cancellation headphones, or, you know, maybe not noise cancellation because you want to be aware and you want to be present in that moment, but just laying down on the bed, right? Being with myself and breathing in deeply. How does that feel? What does that look like as my body, as like I inhale, what is my body doing as I'm exhaling? What am I releasing? Like, what am I hearing in the background? The taste in my mouth? What, like, just the tiny little things that we don't pay attention to. I think that's the perfect way for a beginner to kind of get into being mindful. And as we continue to do these mindful exercises, it allows us to truly feel at ease, to feel at peace, because we're able to live our lives and be present, but to not judge ourselves at the same time, which is really the best way to live.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like mindfulness is almost a state of hyper awareness, which I would be worried for some people would like kind of trigger some anxiety or something. How do you avoid that?
Wow, okay, yeah. So again, mindfulness is definitely like meditation, but not in an overwhelming state. So for somebody who ruminates like myself or catastrophizes like myself, it's very easy for that quiet space or even just being very presently aware, it can turn into like a freaking me movie yet again, because you might get warped up in your own stuff, right? So when that happens, that's okay. Take a step back and maybe try it again, later, but sometimes mindfulness is not for everybody. There are so many different coping mechanisms out there that can help you, and that we'll dive into.
At some point, I'd like to talk about how tarot can be used as a tool for reflection.
Yes, definitely. I actually just started getting into tarot because of you, because you're awesome. And so, yeah, it can definitely be a tool. It's really just there to read your energy. And I think there's such a major misconception about it, but we'll get deep into that another time.
We really hope that you're enjoying these segments and that they're of use.
Today's information, just as a source, was mindful.org.
We just heard from two of Sanctuary's own, Hannah and Jules, in their segment on mindfulness. To share your thoughts, stories, and different ways of healing yourself with Hannah and Jules, please contact them at info@mediasanctuary.org.
And in our last segment tonight, Sophia K. Helene interviewed Professor Esther Wirtz from RPI about her research in physics and about being a woman in STEM field as part of the new weekly radio bucket.
My name is Sophia Cahalane, and I am here with Professor Esther Wirtz from RPI, and we're going to be talking about women in STEM. Hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
Great, and it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, and I'm glad you were able to come down to the sanctuary and do this.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. This is my first time here, and I love it.
Awesome. So I have a couple questions. First of all, how did you get interested in STEM, the STEM field?
So I guess it depends if you want the serious answer or the sort of crazy answer, I guess.
Crazy answer, yeah. Definitely.
All right. So as a kid, I was really into science fiction, and I loved the idea of aliens. So I really wanted to meet aliens. But I'm not completely nuts, and I realized that the probability of me doing that wasn't very high, but that studying the stars would bring me closer to that sort of impossible dream. And so that's sort of what put me on the path of physics, just wanting to meet aliens. And then, you know, I just went for it. I did not end up studying astrophysics or stars or anything remotely related to aliens, but I stuck with the love of physics.
I mean, it's still pretty good. So what are you studying instead of alien life?
So I'm interested in light-matter interactions. So basically, on the one hand, I'm interested in developing new techniques, new optical techniques that can allow us to investigate matter on the nanometer scale. So typically with an optical microscope, you can't do that because you're limited by what's called the diffraction limit. So you can't look at things that are smaller than 200 nanometers, or you can't distinguish features that are smaller than that. But my work is trying to break that limit. So trying to develop new ways to look at things optically with better resolution.
So you're going very small into
I mean, it sort of depends what you consider to be small. So a particle physicist would say that my stuff's still pretty big because it's on the nanometer scale and not, you know, on the fraction of angstroms.
And angstroms are?
They're the size of an atom. And a nanometer is a thousandth of the width of a hair, typically.
Okay. So for normal people who don't study light and matter interactions, that's definitely quite on the small side.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So do you have an example of what this kind of new technology or new research that you're doing could be used for in like kind of everyday life or something?
So I don't know that you would use this in everyday life. The sort of the basic technique that I base my improvements on were developed. Those techniques were developed for biophysics. So it's a lot of sort of helping understand how bacteria work, so preventing disease and things like that. I'm one step back, I would say, from application. So I'm interested in understanding these light-matter interactions in order to build devices that could be used potentially for a quantum computer or quantum information science.
Okay. So just kind of a background, almost like research area, and then letting other people kind of use that to.
Yeah, so it would be proof of principle. So I do the understanding how the light matter interaction works, and then use that understanding to prove if I can use certain types of structures and nanostructures to have a quantum transistor, for example.
All right. So that was most of your information on kind of what you're researching in your school and field. And I'm curious, as part of my radio bucket, I'm doing women in STEM. So can you tell me more about kind of what you've experienced as a woman in the physics field? Like, have you ever experienced imposter syndrome? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So I think everyone experiences imposter syndrome. I think both men and women experience it equally, but women tend to maybe influenced more by it, and it may last longer. So I've experienced imposter syndrome my whole life, and I have to admit that even though, you know, I'm a tenure track professor now at a really good school, I still, you know, wake up some days thinking I shouldn't be here. I just got lucky. What am I doing? People are going to realize that, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about. So it's something that I still live with, and so I have to sort of fight it every day and sort of keep on convincing myself that I do deserve what I've gotten, or, you know, that I've worked hard to get here. But, you know, talking to my male colleagues, I know that they have also experienced this, but it's maybe something that they were more easily able to overcome, just because looking around them, they see lots of other white men in this position. And so
it's about representation and kind of knowing that you can make it because others similar to you, in whatever way that means, have made it before.
Right.
Okay. So, and you talked about, you know, discussing this with your peers in the field. What have you experienced from them in terms of, like, being a woman? Do you ever feel kind of outside, or like that they might look down on you in any way just because you're a woman and they're mostly men?
Yeah. I mean, so I would say that most of my interactions have been with, you know, my physics colleagues has been really good and positive. And I can't think off the top of my head of any overt comments that were, you know, that anyone telling me, you don't belong here, you know, a woman shouldn't be a physicist or anything like that. I think the difficulties I've experienced have mostly been due to unconscious bias. And so those sort of little digs that aren't necessarily meant negatively, but come off as maybe you don't really belong here. So some of them sound positive on, you know, at first hearing, but then, you know, it sort of still feels a little upsetting. So things like, oh, you don't look like a physicist, which is my typical example because, you know, I hear it regularly, you know, from when I was a student till now, which, you know, what is a physicist supposed to look like? Why can't I look like a physicist? Or why am I not the representation of a physicist? And I do think things are changing that now if you ask kids, somebody told me recently that a recent survey showed that if you ask kids, draw a scientist, now they do start drawing women with a greater or a greater fraction of them do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those types of comments are really mostly what I've experienced. And there are all these things that sort of follow from that. So research shows that it's harder for women to get grants and to publish papers and to get promoted for all these unconscious reasons. It's not that people are actively trying to keep women out of the field or to keep, you know, women from getting promoted. It's just these unconscious thoughts that men are better at math and physics and science in general than women.
Yeah. That's really hard, especially I think getting those comments from men. They might say them thinking like, oh, whatever, it's just kind of a throwaway comment. But for women who may have experienced this before or have been experiencing it for their whole lives, it's just kind of like, it's hard to kind of come back from that every time when it keeps repeating and happens again and again. It's definitely like overbearing in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just one last question. What kind of message would you want to share with young girls or people interested in career in science, and like something that in order to encourage them to pursue such
a
thing?
I mean, I think, first of all, everyone has the same capacity for STEM, so science, technology, engineering, and math. So both women and men, people of color who are also underrepresented in the field, we're all very capable. And so, you know, if you discover that you like doing experiments in your backyard, you know, testing the water or whatever, you should not give up on that because someone tells you that you're not as going to be as good as your brother.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Professor, for coming in and speaking to me on this topic.
My pleasure.
Have a good day.
All right, great. Thank you.
That was Professor Esther Wirtz from RPI discussing her research and her experiences as a woman in the field of physics. And Guy, guess what?
Is it that time again?
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm still Livonia Mallory.
And I've remained Guy Schaefer throughout the entire episode. Our engineer tonight is Sophia Kaelane. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio show, send us an email to info@mediasanctuary.org. That's info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.